From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Most strikingly at the end of the execution, as those three were heading out, they yelled, the state of California just killed an innocent man, which is the first time I've ever heard any outburst in the death chamber.
A reporter describing the death scene at San Quentin after the state of California executed Stanley Tookie Williams early this morning. Angela Davis was outside San Quentin with thousands of others.
The death penalty is a direct inheritance of slavery. Direct. Because of the...
Hours before Williams was executed, he spoke with Pacifica Station WBAI.
Redemption. I can say it no better than that. That's what I'd like the world to remember me. That's what I'd like my legacy to be remembered as.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Please excuse my voice. I have laryngitis. In California, Stanley Tookie Williams was executed by lethal injection early this morning by the state of California. He was 51 years old. On Monday, California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger refused to spare his life. Williams was co-founder of the Crips street gang. He was jailed after being convicted of four murders in 1979. He later became an advocate against gang violence, was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. Early this morning, over 2,000 people gathered outside San Quentin Prison to protest his execution, including Reverend Jesse Jackson.
Obviously very disappointed that the governor has missed a moment to choose life over death, has missed a moment to choose redemption over revenge.
We'll have more on the life and death of Stanley Tookie Williams in a few minutes. In Hong Kong, the World Trade Organization ministerial meeting has opened up amid mass protest. At the center of the demonstrations have been a group of farmers from South Korea. Members of the group tried to gain access to the WTO meeting by swimming through Victoria Harbor. In the streets, police fired pepper foam to block demonstrators from getting near the ministerial meeting. About 15 activists were able to make it inside during the opening address of WTO Director General Pascal Lamy. The demonstrators unveiled signs reading, "The WTO kills farmers and no to the WTO." Critics of the World Trade Organization charge the WTO has undermined democracy around the world by promoting the trade agenda of multinational corporations. This is French farmer and activist José Bové.
Today, the opening of markets is a real danger for most farmers in the South and the North. That's why the trade talks are a delusion, and we oppose the European agricultural policy and the U.S. one, which are still hiding their export subsidies.
That was José Bové speaking in Hong Kong. In Australia, police are preparing for a possible third night of civil unrest following some of the worst racial violence in Australia's history. On Sunday, a mob of 5,000 people rampaged across Cronulla Beach near Sydney, chanting racist slogans, attacking men and women of Lebanese descent. Some of the attackers had wrapped themselves in the Australian flag and chanted, "No more Lebs." More than 30 people were injured, 16 arrested. Racially motivated attacks were also reported in the Western Australian city of Perth. This is the Australian Prime Minister, John Howard.
Mob violence is always sickening and always to be unconditionally condemned. Attacking people on the basis of their race, their appearance, their ethnicity is totally unacceptable and should be repudiated by all Australians, irrespective of their own background and irrespective of their politics.
Last night, 11 arrests were also made after a group of men of Middle Eastern descent went back into the town of Cronulla for what police described as revenge. On Thursday, Australian state lawmakers plan to hold a special session to consider new laws to allow police to lock down areas and give police greater power to conduct searches and confiscate cars. In news in Iraq, Wednesday marks the 1,000th day since the U.S. invasion. On Monday, President Bush again defended his decision to go to war and said 30,000 Iraqis have died so far. The admission marks one of the few times an administration official has cited a death toll in Iraq. Some outside estimates put the Iraqi civilian death toll over 100,000. On Monday, President Bush blamed the Arabic media for the deteriorating image of the U.S. abroad.
Look, I recognize we got an image issue, particularly when you got television stations, Arabic television stations, that are constantly just pounding America, you know, creating, saying, America is fighting Islam, America can't stand Muslims, this is a war against a religion. And we've got to obviously do a better job of reminding people that ours is not a nation that rejects religion, ours is a nation that accepts people of all faith. And that the great strength of America is the capacity for people to worship freely. It's difficult. I mean, their propaganda machine is pretty darn intense. And so we're constantly sending out messages. We're constantly trying to reassure people. But we're also acting.
President Bush's comments come just weeks after it was revealed the U.S. has been paying the private firm, the Lincoln Group, to plant articles in the Iraqi press and pay off sympathetic Iraqi journalists. Bush's comments didn't mark the first time he's criticized the Arabic media. Last month, the Daily Mirror of London reported Bush considered bombing the headquarters of Al Jazeera in 2004. In Iraq, ABC News and Time magazine has conducted a nationwide poll of Iraqis ahead of the week's elections. It found more than two-thirds of those surveyed oppose the presence of U.S. troops in Iraq. Only 44% of the country feels Iraq is better off now than it was before the war. In Washington, the Supreme Court announced Monday it would determine whether the Texas state legislature illegally redrew the state's congressional district barriers 2 years ago. The redrawn map resulted in Republicans gaining an extra 4 seats in Congress. Critics say the redistricting diluted the voting strength of Latinos and African Americans in Texas in violation of the Voting Rights Act. Justice Department lawyers initially recommended rejecting Texas' redistricting plan, but were overruled by senior justice officials. A group of U.S. activists have begun a vigil near the gates of the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay. Members of the group, Witness Against Torture, walked for 5 days across Cuba to reach Guantanamo. Military officials rejected their request to meet with any of the 500 or more prisoners who are being held without charge. This is Frida Berrigan speaking outside Guantanamo.
We're fasting, most of us fasting just on water, some people drinking some juice, fasting and praying and hoping that our intentions reach the prisoners, that somehow through the power of prayer, they will feel our presence, feel our solidarity. At the same time, we're calling on people in the United States to call President Bush, to call Donald Rumsfeld, to get in touch with the base here in Guantanamo so that we might be let in to visit the prisoners, to visit the soldiers, American soldiers who are here, and to open up this modern heart of darkness to the light of day and to the light of world scrutiny.
That was Frida Berrigan of Witness Against Torture. And the chief executive of the electronic voting machine manufacturer Diebold, Walden O'Dell, has resigned. In 2003, O'Dell made headlines when he wrote, he's, quote, committed to helping Ohio deliver its electoral votes to the president next year.
Pale horse coming, and I'm gonna ride it. I'll rise in the morning, my fate decided. I'm a dead man walking. I'm a dead man walking. In St. James Parish, I was born and christened. I've got my story, mister, ain't no need for you to listen. It's just a dead man talking. Once I had a job, I had a girl. Between our dreams and actions lies this world. In the deep forest, their blood and tears rushed over me.
All I could feel was the drugs in the shotgun and my fear up inside of me like a dead man talking.
Bruce Springsteen, Dead Man Walking, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Again, please excuse my voice. I have laryngitis. Stanley Tookie Williams is dead. He was executed by the state of California, 12:35 a.m. Pacific time, by lethal injection at San Quentin State Prison. He was 51 years old. A co-founder of one of the country's most notorious street gangs, the Crips, Williams spent 24 years on death row for the murders of four convenience store workers. During this period, he became a Nobel Peace Prize nominee, children's author, a vocal advocate against gang violence while he was in prison. He maintained his innocence up until his death. The execution was attended both by the victims' families and several of Stanley Williams' supporters. After he was pronounced dead, several reporters who were witness to the execution held a news conference and described what happened.
Well, you have somewhat obstructed views, and we were discussing on the way back who saw and who heard what. So I think you might get something slightly different from each of us. He came in without any kind of resistance shortly after 12, it seemed. He was helped onto what I guess is a converted dentist chair and was strapped down, and at no point did he seem to give any kind of resistance whatsoever. He did, while they were tapping his veins, lift his head several times to look around at people. He seemed for the most part to be looking over to a section where there appeared to be some of his supporters. At one point he looked directly over at us. It was hard to see if he was just looking at the press in general or anybody in particular. And he was declared dead at 12:35.
They had some trouble with the second IV, which was in the left arm. It took them, it may have been 10 minutes to deal with that. Williams at one point grimaced, or it looked almost out of frustration or at the difficulty there. It took till 12:22 thereabouts before they a female guard gave the announcement that the execution would begin. So there's a 13 or 14 minute actual execution, the first part of which he was lifting his head, and then it fell again down to the, I guess you call it a pad, did that a few times, breathing pretty heavily, and then you would see sort of a rise in sort of his stomach area up and down, a few times, or more than a few times, I guess. And then after a few minutes, his breathing slowed, and then you didn't see anything for several minutes. And everybody was sort of attentive, watching this lifeless body. And I'll just turn it over to Kevin.
Well, this is the sixth one I've seen here at San Quentin, and I have to say this was very different. There were the most notable thing was that Williams had supporters at the back of the room. Ms. Becknell was among them, I understand. We could see them, and throughout the last part of the preparing him, when he was still conscious, they gave what looked like Black Power salutes several times to him, a one man and two women. And most strikingly at the end of the execution, as those three were heading out, they yelled, the state of California just killed an innocent man, which is the first time I've ever heard any outburst in the death chamber there. And the folks who were there on behalf of the victims, they were stony. They were very impassive. But at the very end, when those three yelled that out, Dora Owens, the stepmom of one of his victims, began to cry.
Laura.
And that was different. That was a very emotional element of this particular execution.
I had a good look at the Williams supporters, other than raising their fists in the air. At times, they blew kisses to him. They said, they whispered, I love you, God bless you. Stanley Williams was speaking a lot throughout this process. We don't know what he was saying. His head was tilted to the left where his contingent was, and he was talking a lot, it appeared. Mostly, you talked about the victim's stepmother, Ms. Owens, and not until the very end did she show any sort of emotion. She was looking just straight at Williams the entire time, did not move whatsoever. But the Williams contingent did move around a lot, and as was said, they had that that outburst at the end as they left the room.
I had an extremely obstructed view, so I don't have a lot to add, other than it seemed to me that it was taking much longer than Williams thought it would. He kept lifting his head, shaking his head, putting it back down, almost as if. It seemed like disgust to me and frustration. And I thought he said, I don't know if anyone else heard this, but you doing that right? Did anyone hear that but me?
It was very hard to hear in there. The fact that the glass is super thick.
I was struck by two things. I was struck by what a personal process it was, and that all the people attending to him had their hands on him most of the time. One guard near the right side of his head in particular was touching his upper arm a lot of the time, I think in an effort to comfort him. There was a lot of, quite a bit of talking. Tukey would talk to the people attending, and at times they spoke back to him. He lifted his head a lot, looked around. I was struck by how long it took. It was at least 22 minutes from when he entered the room to when they read the death warrant. There was just an awful lot of sticking needles and taping things down, and he raised his head several times and spoke to them. He looked exasperated at the length of the process of doing this. And by my watch, it was 36 minutes and 15 seconds from when he walked in the room alive to when they declared him dead.
We'll take a few questions. If you have any of you have questions for these individuals.
Are you able to see if he had any last words when the warden asked him that question, or do you know?
We were told his last words were issued several hours ago and given to the warden, and you'll hear those later. But there were no official last words in our presence.
How many members of the victims were actually there?
We don't know.
It was hard to tell. The count was supposed to be five, and there seemed to be five people who might have been representatives of the victims, but you can't ask any questions in there.
And the witnesses are not identified to us.
And of the victim's family, in terms of emotion, really, it just wasn't until the very end, like we said, the rest just sat there and stood and
Can you clarify the interaction that was taking place between Tukey Williams and his supporters?
They were very intent. His Mr. Fleming, I believe, was one of his attorneys who was in there. He and another attorney, then the two women and the other man, were staring at him most of the time, and they looked very frustrated that it was taking so long. Particularly the two women, Ms. Becknell and her friend. They stood apart from the others, and they stared very intently at him. One time they were praying, like this. And then, of course, several times they raised their fists up, and he raised up, like Steve was saying, a few others. He raised up and tried to look at them quite a lot. And it seemed like toward the very end, he was trying to keep his head up. Did you see this too?
Yeah.
He was trying to keep his head up as long as he could, until the first drugs hit him.
And did they say things to each other? I mean, was there verbal communication?
Between Williams' supporters and Williams himself, they were mouthing things to each other. I could only see just the Williams contingent saying things like, I love you, God bless you.
In the beginning,
like
he
that.
Had his head turned to the left toward them, toward presumably Barbara Becknell. He had his glasses on the whole time. He kept them on. And he kept looking over there. Only once did he really turn to the right where we were and sort of look around to see who was there or from what he can see.
The shot at you just killed an innocent man. How did that go down?
That was right as they left. As soon as they announced the death warrant or the death notice, the people started filing out, and his supporters were the first to go out. And just as they were heading out the gate, they turned back, the three of them, and yelled this.
An excerpt of the news conference held after the execution of Stanley Tookie Williams early this morning. A crowd of over 2,000 people, most opposed to Williams' execution, protested outside. We'll hear from one of those there, Angela Davis, after this break. Escape.
Suddenly born into color, my brother, do it now. You're covered with this thick cloud. Slide out the side, die and be quiet. It is the surest sign. Quietness will let you.
This is Democracy Now. I'm Amy Goodman. Stanley Tookie Williams' fate was sealed Monday afternoon when California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger rejected his final appeal for clemency. Another plea to the Supreme Court was rejected later in the evening. Schwarzenegger also turned down a last-minute request to grant a stay of execution despite the emergence of four new witnesses Williams' lawyers argued could help exonerate him. Williams' defense team immediately denounced the judgment and vowed to press their client's case until the final moment. Williams' attorney, Jonathan Harris, held a news conference by phone after the clemency appeal was denied.
What these people have come forward and said is in accordance with and corroborates what Stanley Williams has been saying for 25 years, which is that he is innocent. Now, the governor has denied our petition for clemency on grounds Stanley Williams is guilty, and his refusal to admit and confess to these crimes denies his personal atonement. And I asked the governor to give us a stay, to give us time to investigate these men who have come forward. They have offered us the names of other individuals who would corroborate those statements. We are actively looking for those people. In fact, we are talking to one of those people this afternoon, and we will be filing a request with the governor this afternoon for a stay while we continue to investigate these claims of innocence. Beyond that, California has a moratorium legislation pending, AB 1121, which is going to be voted on in January. And this moratorium legislation would put a moratorium on all death penalties in California while a California Commission on the Fair Administration of Justice, bipartisan commission, looks at the application of the death penalty in California. It would be a sad, tragic, and dishonorable day for California if Stanley Williams were to be the last person executed before this moratorium went into effect. And we are calling on the governor to stay the execution pending a vote on that bill. Thank you very much.
That was Jonathan Harris, attorney with the defense team of Stanley Tookie Williams, speaking on Monday. Williams became one of the most celebrated death row cases the country has seen in years, championed by prominent political and community figures like the Reverend Jesse Jackson, professor and activist Angela Davis, Sister Helen Prejean, and entertainers such as the rap artist Snoop Dogg and the actor Jamie Foxx. This is Alice Huffman of the NAACP.
I must tell you, we are deeply saddened by the governor's decision to not grant clemency to Stanley Tookie Williams. We believe this is a serious blow to our efforts to eliminate gangs and to create a safer environment. We believe that Stanley Tookie Williams' life has value above any notion of an eye for an eye, which is the premise of the death penalty. Obviously, the governor believes otherwise. We believe that every child Stanley Williams Tookie is able to draw away from gang life is invaluable. Obviously, the governor does not. We believe that one can reform and become rehabilitated from wherever one resides. Stanley, for the last 10 years, has made a difference in the lives of inner-city children all over the world. We think that the work of his should set the stage for him to be granted clemency, of the permission to continue. Obviously, the governor did not see it that way. The national NAACP, the state NAACP, local branches and youth units, the California Chamber, the Urban League, the ACLU, and many other groups that are opposed to the death penalty, all calling for clemency, were not heard. It is clear that we have no voice and no standing with this governor. We regret that the governor does not understand or care about the injustices of the criminal justice system and the disparities with which we live, that erodes our trust in the system. Even after an inmate has come forth at the 11th hour to provide evidence that Stanley Williams was framed inside the prison, the governor would not listen. I regret that the governor has abandoned the secret canon of redemption. He does not believe that from someone that's bad, a change can come, a new beginning, and that person can be an instrument of good.
Alice Huffman of the NAACP. The Reverend Jesse Jackson was one of the last people to meet with Stanley Tookie Williams yesterday. He also denounced the decision by the governor to deny Williams clemency.
Obviously very disappointed that the governor has missed a moment to choose life over death, has missed a moment to choose redemption over revenge. We've seen these last few years 122 people walk off of death row who had been wrongfully convicted. We've seen people whose lives have been turned around in the process. Cookie has made a great contribution, Tookie has, these last few years. And I would have hoped the governor would have seen the opportunity here to expand hope. I hope that recycled despair does not come out in hurtful ways. Tookie certainly discourages any form of violence in reaction to this decision. He feels that any act of street violence would undermine the impact of his teaching and his legacy. He does not want any violent expression or street ugliness to mar his teaching.
The Reverend Jesse Jackson at San Quentin. We turn now to Angela Davis, longtime prison activist, professor, University of California, Santa Cruz, author of a number of books, including Are Prisons Obsolete? Women, Race, and Class, and her latest is Abolition, Democracy, Prisons, Democracy, and Empire. Angela, you were outside the death chamber. You were outside the San Quentin prison last night into the morning. Can you talk about your response to execution and to what was happening outside?
Of course, it was a very sad moment. But the thousands of people who gathered there dedicated themselves to keeping Tookie Williams' spirit alive. I must say, I have attended other vigils. This is the largest vigil I have ever seen. I'm not sure exactly how many people were there, but it seemed like thousands. During the last portion of the protest and vigil, young people, in this extremely moving gesture, read from Tookie Williams' books. A young man after a young woman after a young man after a young woman gave very moving renditions of the lessons that that Tookie Williams has left to us about the importance of nonviolence, the importance of turning away from the gang life. And as I stood there imagining what was happening in the death chamber, it seemed to me that this might very well be the beginning of something very new. The campaign against the death penalty has been, while a powerful campaign, its participants have been those who attend all of the vigils, a relatively small number of people. There were, last night, huge numbers of people, multi-generational, extremely diverse crowd, and everyone was both very sad and at the same time, it seemed to me, very dedicated to continuing the campaign against capital punishment, against injustices brought on by the prison system, against racism, for peace, for justice, for equality.
Angela Davis, I wanted to turn to an excerpt from Governor Schwarzenegger's written response to Tookie Williams' clemency appeal when he denied it. Schwarzenegger writes, quote, "The dedication of Williams' book, Life in Prison, casts significant doubt on his personal redemption. This book was published in 1998, several years after Williams claimed redemptive experience." Schwarzenegger goes on to write, specifically, the book is dedicated to Nelson Mandela, Angela Davis, Malcolm X, Assata Shakur, Geronimo Jijaga Pratt, Ramona Africa, John Africa, Leonard Peltier, Daruba al-Mujahid, George Jackson, Mumia Abu-Jamal, and the countless other men, women, and youths who have to endure the hellish oppression of living behind bars. Schwarzenegger goes on to say, the mix of individuals on this list is curious. Most have violent pasts, and some have been convicted of committing heinous murders, including the killing of law enforcement. Schwarzenegger goes on to particularly single out the inclusion of George Jackson in Williams' dedication. George Jackson, the jailed Black Panther member gunned down by prison guards at San Quentin in 1971. Angela Davis, you stood trial and were acquitted of taking part in a courtroom raid that sought Jackson's release. Can you respond to this part of Schwarzenegger's denial of Williams' clemency appeal?
Well, it seems to me that we saw a very intentional politicalization of this process, namely the equation of what Schwarzenegger would call lawlessness and criminality with radical political activism. It is revealing, it seems to me, that every single name he evoked by quoting the dedication from Tookie's autobiography, every single name is the name of a person of color, a Black person or a Native person. And of course, we have Nelson Mandela, who is a global hero, who represents to us the determination to dismantle racism and sexism and economic exploitation. It is very frightening to me that Schwarzenegger would make such a statement, particularly in light of the assaults on people's rights associated with the Patriot Act. This feels like an even more intense kind of McCarthyism that's happening here. And it was particularly ironic that he said that Williams is not reformed and he still sees violence and lawlessness as legitimate, as what he called a legitimate means to address societal problems. This is ironic since Stanley Tookie Williams has publicly embraced nonviolence. And as I said this evening when I spoke at the rally, this execution is the most outrageous example of using violence, of using state violence as a legitimate means of addressing social problems.
What about the issue that Schwarzenegger raised and others, that Stanley Tookie Williams, if he was truly engaged in redemption, would ask for forgiveness, admit his crime and ask for forgiveness?
Well, Stanley Tookie Williams did repeatedly express remorse for all of the terrible things he admitted he had done in his youth. At the same time, he indicated that time and time again that he was not guilty of the particular crimes with which he was charged. It would have actually been easy for him to admit guilt, even though he is innocent. It would have been very easy for him to admit guilt, apologize for the purpose of guaranteeing that he might receive clemency from Governor Schwarzenegger, but he maintained his innocence until the very end. And, of course, there has been little discussion about the actual evidence and the trial. There's been little discussion of the witnesses who testified against him, the jailhouse informant, for example. Because there was no DNA or what they call factual evidence in the case, and this is what I think is quite dangerous about the assumption that the only way innocence can be demonstrated is through DNA. I would say parenthetically that I happened to catch on CNN an interview with a man who had been released from death row in Illinois based on DNA evidence, and he told the CNN reporter that he believed that Tookie Williams should be executed because there was no actual innocence. There was no factual evidence of his innocence. This is very frightening to me because it means that the so-called scientific production of innocence can, as a matter of fact, boomerang against all of those who are not able to mobilize such evidence. And it might boomerang against the notion that we need to abolish the death penalty because it is wrong. No one, regardless of guilt or innocence, should be put to death by the state during this day and age.
Angela Davis, I want to thank you very much for being with us, and a safe trip to Paris. What words will you bring to the conferences you speak at in France?
The words I will bring will emphasize the importance of generating stronger global solidarity. There is widespread sentiment against the death penalty in France, of course, throughout Europe, and increasingly in other parts of the world as well. I should point out that the Côte d'Ivoire just recently abolished the death penalty. Senegal just recently abolished the death penalty. So I will bring a message of hope that the state of California may have extinguished the life of Stanley Tookie Williams, but the state has not managed to extinguish the hope for a better world.
Angela Davis, thank you very much for being with us. Professor, University of California, Santa Cruz. Her latest book is Abolition Democracy, Prisons, Democracy, and Empire. As we turn now to Stanley Tookie Williams in his own words, hours before he was executed, recorded at WBAI Pacifica Radio on Wake Up Call, an interview that he did with WBAI's Kat Aaron as she asked him for his thoughts as he faced what turned out to be the last day of his life.
Well, I feel good. And my redemption shines. I got up this morning. I cleansed myself. I prayed. I exercised. And now I'm talking to you. Well, prior to talking to you, I was talking to my mother. And of course, she's quite encouraging, spiritual, and so am I. and my lack of fear for this barbaric methodology of death, I rely upon my faith. It has nothing to do with machismo, with manhood, or with some pseudo former gang street code. This is pure faith and predicated on my redemption. So, therefore, I just stand strong and continue to tell you, your audience, and the world that I am innocent. And yes, I've been a wretched person, but I've redeemed myself. And I say to you and all those who can listen and will listen that redemption is tailor-made for the wretched. And that's what I used to be. So, I can answer one more before I go.
There are millions of people all around the country and indeed the world who are standing in support of you and doing everything that they can to ensure that your life is spared. How would you like the world to imagine your legacy, one that we all hope does not begin tomorrow but begins in many years from today?
I appreciate you making that statement. But I've been asked the same query not too long ago. And I said, just one word. Just one word can sum it up. In a nutshell. And that is redemption. I can say it no better than that. That's what I'd like the world to remember me. That's what I'd like my legacy to be remembered as. A redemptive transition. Something that I believe is not exclusive just for the so-called sanctimonious, the elitist. And it doesn't, it's not predicated on color or race, social stratum, or one's religious background. It's accessible for everybody. That's the beauty about it. And whether others choose to believe that I've redeemed myself or not, I worry not, because I know, and God knows, and you can believe that all the youths that I continue to help, they know too. So with that, I'm grateful. So I thank you for the opportunity, and I say to you and everyone else, God bless. So take care.
Stanley Tookie Williams, speaking on WBAI Pacifica Radio to Kat Aaron, hours before he was executed by the state of California. He died 12:35 a.m. this morning, Pacific time. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute.
Que sera, que sera.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn to another state execution that happened more than 15 years ago, 1993, the state of Texas executed Reuben Cantu. He was convicted at the age of 18, only 26 years old, when killed by lethal injection. Reuben Cantu was charged with committing murder and robbery. During his 8 years on death row, he maintained his innocence. Just 4 days after his sentencing, Cantu wrote in a letter addressed to the citizens of San Antonio, Texas, quote, "I have been framed in a capital murder case." In 1987, he wrote to the Board of Pardons and Paroles saying, "I was tried and convicted on bogus evidence. And now, more than a dozen years after his execution, it appears he was telling the truth." The single eyewitness has recanted his testimony against Cantu, and Cantu's alleged co-defendant has signed an affidavit saying he allowed his friend to be falsely accused. We turn now to the Houston Chronicle reporter who's been investigating this case. Lisa Olson joins us from Houston. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
It's good to have you with us, and sorry for my laryngitis. Can you lay out for us the story of Reuben Cantu?
Well, Reuben Cantu was a teenager growing up in the south part of San Antonio in the Barrio, and he attended special education classes at South San High School. He also was a member of a group of neighborhood teens that they called the Gray Eagles, ran around on the streets with other kids. His parents were divorced. He got involved in stealing cars. He was known by neighborhood cops as a kid who got in trouble. And there was a murder that occurred right across the street from his house. And when that happened, he was one of the first kids that they looked at.
And explain what took place, why he was arrested for murder.
Well, he was initially looked at as a suspect, I think mainly just because he lived across the street from the murder and that the murder victim was with another man in a vacant house that was under construction. The second man who survived barely what was a robbery and murder initially did not identify Reuben, but told police that there were two teenagers who attacked him, one who was older, a little bit older, 17, 18, and one who was younger. And all he said initially to the officers was that he thought they were teens from the neighborhood. So they showed him a lot of mug shots of kids from the neighborhood while he was still in the hospital. This victim, whose name is Juan Moreno, was only 19 years old, had barely survived, and was very critically injured. And initially, he did not identify Reuben Cantu. A couple months passed, and Reuben was involved in an argument with an off-duty police officer in a bar called the Scabaroo Lounge, also in South San Antonio. And during that altercation, the officer actually says there wasn't a fight, but Reuben Cantu's version and other people's version that night was that there was a fight. The officer was shot. Reuben's version, again, was that he did not know that this man was a police officer. Joe DeLuz, the officer who was shot, was not in uniform. He was not on duty. He was carrying two concealed weapons. But what happened was the next day, the sergeant in charge of the homicide case again sent an officer out to talk with the surviving witness in the unrelated murder that had happened previously, showed the witness again the photo of Reuben Cantu. On the second pass, the witness again refused to identify Reuben as the shooter. The third day, the same sergeant again sent an officer out to question Juan Moreno. And on the third pass, this time, this 19-year-old boy did identify Reuben Cantu as the shooter and went on to be the only witness in the capital murder trial against Reuben Cantu. Not the only witness, but the only eyewitness, because the co-defendant, who was also identified by Juan Moreno and arrested shortly after that, never testified against Reuben Cantu or gave a statement about the murder at all.
We're talking to Lisa Olson, reporter at the Houston Chronicle, about the case of Reuben Cantu. Can you talk about all the statements he made once he was in prison?
Well, Reuben Cantu consistently told both his lawyers and his family that, yes, indeed, he shot the police officer, but he had nothing to do with the murder for which he was convicted and sentenced to death. He said that he was in Waco, Texas at the time, which is almost 200 miles away from San Antonio. But the people who were supposedly with Rubin were not found and interviewed by his attorneys before his trial. They did find one woman who claimed to be the person who hosted Rubin while this trip occurred, but they never found these other brothers that he always said he was with. And he also said openly, as you read in that letter, that he'd been framed. He felt that the officers had framed him for murder because he had shot this other police officer. And it is true that the sergeant who was working on this case, the murder case, was a very close friend of the police officer who was shot. And he said to me that we could not get him for the other crime, but we got him for this murder. He admitted that the case took the turn it did because of the police shooting, and he refocused the investigation on Rubin Cantu because of what happened in the Scabaroo Lounge, the unrelated incident.
And so today, the officials who are admitting that they made a mistake, can you go through the list from the judge to the prosecutor to the chair of the jury?
Well, before I published this story, I took the information that I had gathered to the key players that you mentioned, and everyone had a reaction of dismay. They were all uniformly concerned about how this could happen. The lead juror, the foreman of the jury, said, you know, we all have our fingers in this. The wrong man was executed. The defense attorney, who is now a judge, said, I was always upset about this process. It was of identification of Rubin Cantu. I always thought the court should overturn his conviction, and this just makes it that much worse. The DA said, looking back, this never should have been a death penalty case. This was a teenager. This was not the kind of evidence that we would have needed, really, to justify a death penalty case. And even the judge, who's more reluctant to believe that Rubin Cantu might have been innocent, says this is a disturbing case, that there seems to be a lot of problems. Why is it that these things did not come out before Rubin Cantu was executed?
Why didn't they come out? How did you break this story?
Well, I think there were a combination of things that happened. One is that Rubin Cantu himself was a very, very quiet person and did tell his lawyers things that he knew that could have helped him and helped them find the other people. Another factor is that the lawyer he had on appeal, even though she's a very good criminal attorney, had never handled a death penalty case at the time, did not have the resources to hire a crack investigator to find either Juan Moreno or to find the people that Rubin Cantu was with, said he was with on the night of the murder. So they were never re-interviewed or found before Rubin Cantu's death. The co-defendant, David Garza, who has come forward and named someone else now as the murderer, never previously gave a statement. He wrote to Nancy Barron, the attorney, and asked her to come and visit him a month before Rubin's execution. But at that point, she was so swamped with deadlines for the Supreme Court, the Fifth Circuit, and the commutation hearing, that she did not go to see him. He wasn't explicit in his letter, and she didn't really believe that he had information that could have exonerated or helped to try to put forward an innocence claim at the last minute for Rubin Cantu.
How about Rubin Cantu's mother? Is she still alive?
Rubin Cantu's mother is indeed still alive inside the doorway of her house in Floresville, Texas. There's a sort of altar monument to Rubin, two pictures she took of him on the day he was executed that she looks at every day. She was outside the night he was executed in a candlelight vigil. She has always maintained that her son was innocent and died innocent.
Is she bringing a suit in this case?
Not that I know of. What's happening in this case right now is the district attorney, Susan Reed, is reinvestigating. She says she's determined to try to figure out what happened, look at everything that was done in the case, and decide if there are other criminal charges that might need to be brought.
Lisa Olson, you're a reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Before that, you worked for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer in Seattle. You did a long series of pieces there on how the death penalty is dealt with in the state of Washington. Can you end with that?
Well, in Washington, one of the things I found in my series was that the level of representation after a conviction or even before a conviction at trial is widely variable in even in a state like Washington, where there is a small number of cases and greater resources dedicated to that area. There was everything from lawyers who had been disbarred to lawyers who were drunk handling death row cases, and there was a significant reform undertaken after the series ran. Texas has largely the same system Washington does, where the judges mainly decide who gets appointed to a death row case on the state level, and that is where, under our current law, actual innocence claims need to be raised at the state writ level. So if you're someone like Ruben Cantu, you have a very complicated actual innocence claim, you may or may not get a lawyer who has the resources or the experience to actually investigate it and bring it before the courts. And that has not changed.
Where you are, Texas and California have the largest death rows in the country. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
And the recommendations that the state of Washington, the Supreme Court, implemented after your series?
They established, they had a process to screen death row lawyers for quality for death penalty cases. They expanded that and made it mandatory. They used to have a recommended list so that judges could pick qualified attorneys if they chose. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in Washington is a very conscientious man, Gary Alexander, set up a committee to look at this issue, and he decided that what needed to happen was that list needed to be mandatory, so that in Washington today, the attorneys who handle death penalty appeal cases are screened by a blue ribbon committee of lawyers who not only consider how many years of experience they have, but look at the quality of their briefs, what kinds of mistakes or gain or wins they've had during their careers, and they are very thoroughly scrutinized.
Lisa Olson, I want to thank you for being with us, reporter at the Houston Chronicle, formerly with the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. Thank you for joining us. Since the death penalty has been reinstated in this country over the last 20 years, on average, a person is executed once every 10 days. That does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nogueira, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Aaron Mate. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Our website is democracynow.org, where you can hear our complete interview with Stanley Tookie Williams, executed early this morning, 12:35 a.m. California time, by the state of California. Again, that website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.